Sean Delaney here with this week's Inside Education, the podcast for educators who are interested in teaching. Thank you to everyone who shared the link to last week's interview with Andy Hargreaves using the Twitter handle at Inside Ed. Your feedback is really encouraging. Remember, you can listen to hundreds of previous episodes of Inside Education by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on podcasts. This week on the programme, I have another great guest for you to meet. Someone who, since we initially discussed recording the interview, has become my full-time colleague. She is the teacher and teacher educator behind the Little Miss Teacher identity on social media, which has the byline, Teach, Inspire, Create. Clara taught in an urban Desh primary school in Dublin for several years, and she is active on her blog, Instagram, Facebook and Twitter accounts with over 10,000 followers across all the platforms. Since August 2019, she has begun working in Merino Institute of Education as an initial teacher educator in the areas of literacy and early childhood education. I met up with Clara and we discussed several items related to her work, her own education and her social media activity. That's where I began our conversation, by asking Clara why she started posting material on social media.
I've always loved writing. So after I finished my master's, there was a really creative element to that, which I really enjoyed. And that's what I liked about the B.Ed. I did originally, that you could do an academic subject with it. So, you got the creative side to things. So somebody actually suggested, why don't you start writing online? Why don't you post, blog posts? So I actually hadn't heard of a blog at that stage. So I had to go and research what that was. And I wasn't really sure where to start. So I just obviously started with what I was most used to, most familiar with, and that was what was going on in the classroom. And around the time that I set up the blog, I had gone from a big leap from sixth class down to infants, which was terrifying for me because I was very comfortable at the senior end. And so I just started documenting my journey coping with junior infants for the first time, and then I found sharing my ideas started to get a lot of traction and interest, and I communicated with a lot of other people with, social media platforms, and it kind of just went from there.
And how did you come up with the title, Little Miss Teacher?
Yeah, a lot of people ask me about that one, and I've had a few people like, will you not change it now because you're a missus and so on? But when I was younger, it was just something that people used to say to me, like, oh, you're such a little miss teacher, or, you're always going to be a teacher. So I kind of took what might have been maybe a little bit of a negative thing when I was younger and turned it into a positive spin.
So it started with the website. Uh-huh. And how often do you maintain the blog now?
It depends. I usually try and get at least one blog post up a week, but I'm not somebody who'll just write something and post it for the sake of it. There's a guy I know on the internet, Gary Vee, and he's all about content and getting as much out as you can, and it doesn't matter if it's good, but just once you're present. But I'd rather, have quality stuff up, and I really enjoy writing posts, but I like to take time to do it. So some weeks I could have 3, 4, or 5 things up, and then you might not hear from me for a week or two, and then I'll get another solid post up again. But I try to appear at least once a week on the actual blog. But social media, like Instagram, is hugely popular at the minute, and I've kind of come away from Facebook because I don't find you get the same. It's just not the same anymore, because you nearly have to pay for posts to appear on the timeline and the news feeds and things. And Instagram, that's where a lot of the younger teachers are now, and you can get your picture up and, a little blurb underneath it. And then that brings a lot more people to your website, I find, as well.
So the website started when?
I think it was about 4 years ago now, 4.5 years. I was living in the IFSC in town. My husband's, he was my fiancé back then, but he's an accountant, so he was away, obviously, during the day when I was on my summer holidays. And I wrote a lot anyway, and I just decided, when I Googled how to set up a website, and off I went, and I used that blogger platform from Google, and I'm still using that. I really should upgrade, but I'm a creature of comfort, I suppose, and I'm still using that. Now, obviously, I've upgraded it and tweaked things over the years to make it look a little bit better, but it's not too complicated.
And how did you evolve then over the 4 years from the blog and the website to Instagram, Facebook and Twitter?
Well, I always had a Facebook account. And that's kind of how I shared when I had something posted on the blog. I would always put a link up on Facebook to get over there. And then I had a personal Instagram account. So I really enjoyed Instagram myself anyway. So then I actually set up a separate teaching page and started sharing things over there. And that brought different visitors into the website. And then Twitter is only something that I've started using really since I came to Marino. It seems to be very popular here, so I've been encouraged to go on Twitter. It's something I was maybe a little bit standoffish about, because Twitter can be a bit scary sometimes. But I have started posting a little bit more over there now.
Yeah. Because we should say that when I asked you to do this interview first, we weren't colleagues, and we are now colleagues. Yes. So that is a welcome thing. But the Twitter has only happened since you came here.
Well, yeah, maybe I've been part time in Marino now for about 2.5 years. So maybe after about a year here, I was encouraged to join Twitter.
What kind of response do you find you get then from the various platforms?
I do find it's pretty positive. It's all very positive. I've rarely had any negative feedback, really. You get a lot more, communication and people getting in touch with you through Instagram. I think it's just easier. You click on direct message and people message you that way. It's easier to like things. There's a lot less scrolling because you have the Instagram stories. So I would go on and talk there a lot. You just post little videos and things, which is nice.
And how do you decide what to put on each of the different platforms?
Well, the great thing now is they're all linked. So if I share one thing on Instagram, it automatically can go to Facebook and Twitter at the same time. Now, generally, I would whatever goes on Instagram, I'll put on Facebook at the same time, so they'll go together. But if it was a tweet, the images don't carry over, so I would go in and do that separately. But generally, it'll be relating to a particular topic that I'm talking about in the blog or something that's relevant to teaching at the minute. So obviously, the new language curriculum is coming out, so I've been trying to talk about that a little bit and encourage people to be positive about it.
Is that difficult?
Yeah, at the minute it is, but change is always difficult. But I think now, since things have been revised and they're a little bit more easy to digest, I think people are a little bit more open to it now, I think.
Because you have a particular interest in the whole area of literacy and early literacies. Mm-hmm. How did that interest come about?
I think it had to come about whenever I jumped from sixth to infants. I had to educate myself. It's not something I remember doing a lot of in college, so I don't like winging it. I don't like kind of spoofing my way through things. So I did a lot of CPD when I went down to infants. I did a lot of reading. I started noticing that there were a lot of online platforms. There's some really brilliant, you know, American websites and literacy consultants, one of whom who used to work here, Molly Cura. So I actually found people like that online, and I just got interested in the work of Lucy Calkins and people like that myself. And then obviously there's great work that goes on in Ireland as well. I love Tara Concannon Gibney's work and Noreen Hayes, so I would follow their publications a lot. So, yeah.
So what was your approach then to teaching literacy like in the classroom?
Yeah, so I found that it was all very didactic and textbook based, which frightened me a little bit, because obviously the children were coming to school and they weren't ready to start formal literacy. So it took a year or two before I could convince, you know, the way the other people were doing things in the school. I really wanted to bring a multi-sensory kind of approach to it and a more natural way of learning for the young children. We didn't, I suppose play is only becoming really popular again now, which is crazy when you think about it in Ireland. But so I went and did, you know, training for the ASTER courses and things like that, and started teaching through play. And I tried to bring play throughout the day in the classroom. So there was a very limited amount of time throughout the day where the children were actually sitting in their seats doing formal work, that they were still doing an immense amount of language learning and emergent writing and reading, but it was all through play. And
so could you give an example of a day, and maybe of what you might do, and you know, how would the day start from early in the morning, and how literacy and play are intermingling?
So before I go through anything, I think I should point out that the school that I taught in was really unusual. It was an urban school on the south side of the city, but we had over 32 languages, I think it was, in the school, and only 21% of the children actually spoke English as their first language. So before they ever came into school, they were already coming in with a language barrier. So automatically, we were going to have to do a huge focus on building their vocabulary and teaching them the language to even cope in the classroom before they ever started to learn. So yeah, that was a big element of it. So obviously play came really naturally into that. So for example, in the mornings, I would have had reception time. So I know a lot of children have to come into school and sit down and kind of get on with work straight away, but I thought it was very important to, you know, let them come in and have a little bit of choice time. They would find toys and things on the table.
Are we talking junior infancy?
Yeah, this is junior infants, yeah. So there'd be lots of fine motor toys and bricks and things for them to play with when they come in. You know, it gave them time to get in, and everybody was there at the same time then before we would actually start the day. It gave everybody a little bit of chance, time to settle, and I would get around and get to have a little chat with everybody. So then everybody was kind of, you know, regulated and ready to start the day, most of the time. Then we would gather on the mats, and we would, you know, it was Catholic school, so we'd do our prayer time, and we would have a little bit of time to share any news, so that saved on interruptions later on in the morning. And I usually always started the day with a story. So then for the rest of the day, most of the learning would be stemming from that story. Now, it might be a story for a week or a fortnight, but I'm very into thematic learning. So regardless of what class I've ever taught in, I've been in fourth, fifth, sixth, and then the juniors across a decade. So stories were always at the heart of it. So
is that storytelling or reading a picture book?
Picture books, novels, but obviously with the infants it was going to be picture books or even wordless picture books, but mostly picture books with text. Yeah, so then after our story time we'd go off and we would do a play-based hour. So I suppose then it was the Astro Hour, which I know we're trying to move on from now, but it worked really well for us. And at that stage I would have had the learning support come into the classroom. That was something that I stopped from the very start. Like, the children weren't taken out. It was more important for me that the children were kept in the room and they weren't missing language and learning that was going on. Because I know when I started teaching first, the thought of another teacher coming into the room used to terrify me. But I think when you get over that, the learning's much more purposeful when you can keep the other adult in the room. And it's nice to have another pair of hands as well.
So you have different groups of children working on different activities, is that right? So what kind of activities might they be?
So there'd always be a sensory play area going on, so it might be your sand or water or messy play. You know, it could be shaving foam or clay or whatever. Then we'd always have the small world. We'd have a socio-dramatic play area always going, so the most of the language was going on there. Then I could have maybe construction. I always had Play-Doh going usually as well, because obviously in the infant class, building up their fine motor skills would be really important. So a lot of the Play-Doh work would revolve around pre-writing skills and building up the little muscles in their fingers and so on. So while the children were very busy playing, there were very specific things that they were doing, preparing them for literacy really. So it was all very literacy based, whether they realised it or not.
And how much would you be interacting with them in their different groups?
I would make a conscious effort to get around each group. The support teacher would have been based at one fixed group every day. So, for example, on a Monday, she would stay at the socio-dramatic group. Maybe Tuesday, she'd go on to the next one. But the learning support teacher then would have a specific amount of language and vocabulary that they'd be working on with the children. And then I would try and get around all the groups, but obviously there'd be target children then that I'd be working on at those times too. But obviously, it wasn't time for me to sit back and correct my copies and get, reading tested or sounds tested or whatever. It was time to circulate.
And the kind of play that children do in school, how different is that from the kind of play that children might do at home?
Well, I know nowadays as well that the type of play children do at home can be very gadget-based. It doesn't take, a lot of imagination or communication or thinking skills. You know, the toys do a lot of the playing for them. I know myself, I have a 14-month-old, and even a lot of the toys that people bring for him are, flashing lights and things that are catchy, but there's not a lot of learning going on with them. So I suppose in school it's they're using physical skills to play. They have to use language to play because they're playing in groups, and anything that they're being given is pretty open-ended. And I would have always tried to promote, the child-led approach. And while I might have had a theme, if the children wanted to run with something else, that's where we went with it, because I found that's where the most language came from then.
You mentioned the stories and the fact that you like the theme-based mm-hmm. teaching. What kind of stories would you have used with your classes, either at the junior end or even through the school?
Well, with the junior end, oh my God, where would I start? My picture books, it kind of always tied into the time of the year and things like that. And for September, what would I have done? We always would have done Farmer Duck, because you're coming into the autumn, and a squash and a squeeze. Anything that got a laugh out of the children, I always found. Even something that might have been, you know, a serious theme, if I had a book that got the children engaged by getting them to laugh, I found that really important. And with the senior classes as well, like getting, I know like a lot of the David Walliams books, you might associate them with, you know, maybe third or fourth class, but I found like getting my reluctant readers in fifth and sixth class on side with the funny books was really important as well. And then bringing in books like Goodnight Mr. Tom, things like that, while they're what, you know, might be regarded as a little bit older now, I always found that fifth and sixth really engaged with them because they were set up, you know, obviously quite a while ago, but they evoked so much empathy. And one of the best books actually probably that I would have ever used with fifth and sixth class was Goodnight Mr. Tom, because there's such a theme of literacy in it, and it's all
Goodnight Mr. Tom,
yeah, and it's all based around, you know, well, at the start anyway, of the young boy Willie not being able to write his postcard home to his mum. And I just remember, like, I think he's 9 years old in the text at that stage. And I always remember the children were just being like, how does he not know how to write his name? You know, and it triggers, you know, for them, like, how important reading and writing is, you know, and there's a point to it.
We've talked a lot about stories and about play, but one of the things I associate you with, or that you've done a lot of work on anyway, is the whole area of phonics. Mm-hmm. So how, first of all, do you bring phonics into your literacy instruction in the early years?
Yes, yeah, so again, that's where the whole multisensory side of things would come into it. I wasn't really sure where to start. There was a programme being used in the school at the time, but I found it was very, you know, it was a bit limited. It was a little bit out of date, and I wasn't really sure if it was working for the type of learners I had. So obviously then I started pulling things from here, there and everywhere. And I have a great aunt, I think she's 96 now. She taught in one of the first Montessori classrooms in Edinburgh back in the 30s, I'm going to say. Yeah, it was the 30s. And she always talked about her sandpaper letters. And I have like some of her actual textbooks from when she was in college as well, by Maria Montessori. And they're incredible, like, and they're still so relevant. Now, her sandpaper letters were lost in my mother's school years ago when there was an asbestos problem. But it was something that I, you know, always remembered, and so I went back to that kind of idea and, you know, started doing multisensory things. So I made my own sandpaper letters, and I started doing things where the children were writing in the air, tracing in sand, basically playing to learn their letters and sounds. And it's something, obviously, I just kind of got really, really interested in the whole area of phonics and emergent literacy and preparing for phonics. And I was finding every year that every class seemed to be getting so drastically different in terms of the abilities they were coming to school with, or the lack of abilities. And I was worried about their pre-writing skills, and children who were struggling to play with Play-Doh then obviously were going to struggle with holding their pencils and things. So every year I pushed it back a couple of months before, you know, or weeks. It was hard because obviously sometimes there's other junior infant classes and they would be raring to go and wanting to start phonics in September, and I would be like, please God, can we do it after Halloween at least? And like, it takes time to obviously get people on board as well, but pushing it out a little bit every year, it seemed to work. You know, there were benefits showing. And actually the latest I left it was November, and now that was a big push to be allowed to do that in a school. But I found that that was actually the year that the children grasped the sound knowledge and their writing skills much more quickly than the other years, because I found the children were forgetting things more quickly. They just weren't ready to start. They didn't have the pre-literacy skills to get started.
And the pressure to start, was that coming from your colleagues, from the principal, from the parents, or from the children?
A mixture of everything, but more so parents. The type of school I taught in, obviously parents are coming from different parts of the world where education looks really different, and you know, they like to see hard results. They like to see lists of sight words. The worst thing that used to happen was they would find out, you know, or somebody might get a notion that we were using a particular program, then they'd go out and buy that program, and they'd have the poor kids working on all these sight words at the weekend, but they hadn't a clue what anything meant, or they couldn't use them in context. And then you'd have parents on Parents' Day being like, but they can read tricky word list 16. And I'm like, but they can't put the word in a sentence, do you know? So getting the parents on board was probably the biggest issue I had. My principal was wonderful. He was very supportive of whatever I did, to be fair. The parents were the biggest part. But I found bringing them in was the best thing to do, and letting them see what the children were doing and getting them on side with play as well, because I used to have an issue with like their punctuality in the mornings because, oh, they're only playing. but like they could be doing really valuable letter work while they were playing and they didn't really get that. So getting them in for literacy for fun, for maths for fun, to do Ashter now and again, and that worked. That was the best thing, I think.
Was there a particular order that you followed when introducing phonics to the children, or did that depend on the programme you were working on at the time?
It kind of just depended on the programme. I would have followed the Jolly Phonics order. I always said I would have used it maybe like a skeleton. You get confidence yourself after a couple of years and you kind of, you know what works and what suits the children. So then I started changing letters around, and then I did away with moving on to digraphs and blends and just focused on the single 26 letters and their sounds for the first year, and found that was more than enough.
What's the difference in a digraph and a blend?
Well, the blend is just when you generally put two letters together. But the digraph might be a mix of like two vowels when you put them together.
So for example, if I take the word, say, head, E-A, is that a digraph?
Yeah, the E-A in the middle is your digraph. But we've got digraphs and diphthongs, and there's all sorts of confusing things. So I think if the children focus on the 26 letters for the first year, then you're doing well. If they get a strong foundation in those, then putting everything else together is much easier.
Okay, so that's phonics, say, at the junior end and junior infants. How long should phonics continue throughout primary school? When should you stop learning phonics?
Phonics should be redundant after second class. By then, all the phonics, you know, bits and pieces should be well taught by then, and then the children move on to all the other elements of reading comprehension and putting all their knowledge, you know, from the first 4 years into context and tackling text and tackling writing and oral language skills.
So can you say a little bit more then about how literacy teaching changes as you move up the school?
Well, I think like the foundations are obviously similar, but building a strong foundation in the first 4 years is really important. Well, obviously the first 2 years is extremely important because it obviously opens up the pathways for all the years to come. But I think as obviously they go up the school, then horizons then are broadened in terms of writing ability, reading ability. But I think one of the most important things is the oral language, because I always believe if they can talk about it confidently, then obviously they'll be able to start writing about it. Motivation for writing, I think there's a big, you know, oral language has a big part to play there, and I think that can get overlooked sometimes. So making time for oral language. I think people panic because you can't see results with oral language on paper. And I know a lot of the students would say it to me as well, but like, you know, if my supervisor works and I've no proof that I did a great lesson yesterday. But the proof is in the children, you know. If they're able to talk about it the next day, then that's your proof. If they're able to explain the topic and answer the questions, and if they're able to answer an inference question or whatever it is you're working on, then that's your proof. So yeah, I think making space for oral language is key in the senior classes too.
And in the junior classes, where does phonics fit in an overall literacy programme?
You see, phonics is only a tiny leaf on the tree of literacy, which I think people forget as well. Like phonics, because of different programmes and things, phonics was actually nearly removed from literacy instruction, which is a bit scary. And then children were learning sounds in isolation. Then they were being taught the name of the letter after that, which was adding more confusion. And then when it came to looking at sight words and things, children were actually really struggling to see that that's actually that sound. Then there's that letter and that's in the word too. They couldn't put it all together. Instead of learning the sound and its name together and seeing the formation of it all in context. And then, like, so when they maybe learn three or four letters, that those three or four letters can actually start to form words. And by sticking them together and blending them and saying their sounds aloud, you can start to see the words appearing. So I think contextualising it is really important for the children, and teaching it all together, not teaching phonics in isolation. They have to see that phonics isn't just this isolated thing. In fact, the children don't really need to hear the word phonics too much at all. They need to see it as reading.
And the new language curriculum that's coming in now, what difference do you think that will make to the teaching of literacy and English more generally in schools?
Well, I think the most important thing at the junior end is that play-based and playful learning is a big feature of it, which is really lovely to see. So there's going to be no escape from play, thank goodness. And at the senior end, I loved, you know, that the critical thinking is such a key part of it now as well, because that's something that children need time to develop and opportunities to develop as well. And now that it's in hard text in front of you, I think there's going to be no getting around it.
And you've been involved in developing a phonics programme. Do you want to just say something briefly about that? And
So I had the pleasure of designing a phonics programme It's a multi-sensory contextualised phonics programme. So it's the first of its kind, really. And it's great to think that it's an Irish programme as well. And I've been on a team of four who I've met through my work here in Marino. And yeah, we've been working on it now for nearly 3 years. It's been a huge process. It's been all very research based. And like one of the authors, Jennifer O'Sullivan, has just completed her PhD in phonemic awareness. So like her knowledge input has been huge in terms of like how we've designed the program as well. And we all had our different parts to play in it. Like Molly Cura is based in Boston. She's an educational consultant, and her training from the States and so on had a huge part to play as well. And then obviously we were under the watchful eye of Jean Megan as well. And it's been really, really interesting. Nobody would really realise the amount of work that goes into it and the amount of hours that go into it. But now that we're starting to see schools taking it on and we're hearing such great feedback from it, it's lovely to see, because it's kind of what we all would have wanted when we were teaching. I know it's certainly what I would have wanted, and all the different multisensory elements are what, you know, I would have been trying to do, spinning lots of different plates with lots of different resources in the classroom, and now it's all there very much in front of us. But I think the really important thing that we have to stress is that it's not a standalone workbook. It's an entire program, and the digital component is the anchor of it. And then obviously the pupil books supplement and support and extend the work that goes on in the digital.
And they do have sandpaper letters.
They do. It's the first of its type. We had to get it printed in Spain for book A, but there are actual sandpaper letters. And there's a mirror. There's a mirror in the book as well for the children to practice their mouth formation as well.
And it's called?
Sounds Like Phonics.
So apart from your interest in literacy, how would you describe your approach to teaching more generally, Clara?
I always adopted a pretty lively, fun approach to teaching. I think I like a laugh. I think it was important that the children liked to laugh. I think it's how I made them feel comfortable in the classroom as well. Like, I was always very approachable. We had fun. We had a lot of fun. And leaving the classroom, you know, to come into third level now full time was like a big decision. But I'd like to think now that I will still get back out to see the children, because you miss the fun that you have with the children as well. It's a brilliant job, and I think if you're not having a laugh every day with the children, then I don't know if it's the place, you know, for you.
And how did you learn to teach? You know the way people say, you know, you go to college and learn to teach, but really it's more complicated than that, because you're an apprentice in a classroom for many years just being a student, and then lots of people and lots of, you know, maybe books you read and things like that influence your teaching. So how did you learn to teach?
I don't think I licked it off a stone. I do come from a family of teachers, although that would have made me very, you know, adamant when I was younger that I'm not going to be a teacher. No, no, no. I'm going to be a journalist. I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be whatever. But the closer it got to, you know, going to college, the more I did think, yeah, I actually would like to do teaching. I think I did work experience in a local school at home in transition, and I was like, oh, this isn't so bad, you know. I had a dream that I'd be a radio presenter. But that died after a week in a country radio station at home, answering the question the phone lines for a quiz from the same guy that used to ring in every day. I was like, oh, I don't know now about this. But yeah, no, I was taught by my mother in fifth and sixth class. I went to a tiny school in the Inishowen Peninsula at school. Literacy levels would have been quite low, but the teachers were absolutely fantastic. I just remember learning was always fun there. I always felt like they were kind of ahead of their time, and I still like would get a lot of my own teaching inspiration from how I was taught there. And like definitely my love of reading and literacy came from primary school. Had great teachers now in secondary school as well, but it's obviously very different when you go to secondary school. But yeah, I don't think I properly learned to teach until I was a teacher. I didn't particularly love college. I loved placement. I found the big lectures weren't that exciting, you know. We were all crammed into a room. We weren't really doing much practical work back then. The only practical thing that stood out to me was doing a music assignment in a group, which was good crack. But yeah, I think you learn on your feet. You learn on placement. You can, obviously, it's a lot different now, and I think it's very practical in college, and that's great. But it takes getting out into your own classroom as well to find your feet and find what works and find what doesn't work as well, and getting confident and finding yourself and who you are. Like, I think you don't really know who you are yourself as a person until you're in your 20s, and then maybe finding out who you are as a teacher takes a little while as well.
And you did go back to college, though, to do a master's. How did that decision come about?
Well, when I was doing my undergrad, I always did want to do English. So I got to do English as an academic, but I always said I'm going to go back and do a master's for myself. I'm not doing a master's in teaching. And I did the master's in children's literature in DCU. And people were like, oh, what are you doing that for? You'll never be a principal, or that's not going to help you with school. But I was a bit like, well, children's literature is a huge part of school. And I don't want to be a principal. I can say that now. And I always knew I didn't want to be a principal. But it was such a lovely 2 years. We had Siobhan Parkinson as one of our lecturers. She was the children's laureate back then. It was just brilliant. It was so creative. It taught us to look at books in totally different ways. It was just right up my street. I loved it. And yeah, it just kept kind of the fire going for literacy. And you were getting to read books and all the novels that you loved when you were a child again, you know, and study them by choice.
And what was it about children's literature? Like, say, for a teacher who maybe hasn't discovered the magic that you're describing in children's literature, what was it that you discovered then, or maybe that you already were aware of?
I just always loved that feeling of getting lost in a book. And I know, I think it was the National Strategy for Literacy and Numeracy, or one of those studies, like, that says that every child deserves the opportunity to get lost in a book. And that's something I really wanted to, you know, bring into my teaching as well. And like, you can see that happening in front of you in the classroom. And like, there's that book, The Book with No Pictures, I think it's BJ Novak that wrote it. And it's mostly nonsense words, but it's aimed at around second class level. But I've used it with the infants, I've used it with sixth class. And you've got kids roaring, laughing around you. But they're totally engaged, they're totally lost. You just see the magic moment clicking, and it's such a great feeling.
And what did you do your dissertation on as part of the master's?
Yeah, well, that was a bit of an abstract one. I actually examined the role of grandparents in children's literature. So it sounds a bit bizarre, but just from the books and texts and different things we were reading, and I suppose the school that I taught in, grandparents had a huge role to play. I think in Ireland, grandparents are very important. And in my own life, my grandparents had a huge role to play in my upbringing and who I am as a person now. And I just noticed in a lot of texts that grandparents kind of were portrayed as pariahs, and it was very hard to find a text that gave a true reflection of grandparents. So I just went back and looked at texts, I think from 1850 up until 2000, I think it was, and looked at the portrayal of grandparents and how it was positive and how it was negative and how they could fix it.
And was it more often negative than positive?
Yeah, very much so.
And any particular books stand out that you kind of remember, oh, that one is an interesting one? Or
yeah, I just remember, like, even the grandparents, like, might have appeared at the start of novels, but they were dead within a couple of chapters, or they were the old, like, decrepit people that were, you know, having to stay in their beds, like in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Or, you know, you might have grandparent figures and not necessarily grandparents, like in Goodnight Mr. Tom. Obviously Tom kind of is a grandfatherly role. Or like, then you've got David Walliams, Gangster Granny, where he takes a whole spin on Granny, who supposedly smells like cabbage but is also a superhero at night time, or I think she's actually a jewel thief. So things like that. Now, like, it sounds daft, but it was actually very interesting.
It sounds like a really interesting topic. I mean, it's a little bit like, I suppose, the step-parents as well, which is another one that can be, they can get a hard rap in children's literature.
Yeah, definitely. And they're kind of, they're nearly underrepresented at times, I think, as well. So, yeah, there's a novel topic for the future, maybe.
Definitely. We're coming near the end, Clara. So there's a few general questions I want to ask you that I often ask guests. And the first one is, what is school for, or what are schools for?
No, I think schools, obviously, while they're a place for learning, obviously, and for developing skills and emergent literacy and numeracy and all the rest, I think obviously schools are a nurturing place as well, and schools are somewhere where the children should feel happy. I think it's always important to remember as well that schools can be that only place of structure for a lot of children in very chaotic lives. And, you know, if you can provide that warmth and structure for just those few hours a day, you're already offering those children so much. And that, you know, I think it's important to look beyond them as a set of results and see them as the child for who they are, and a little personality in front of you with so much potential beyond knowing so many spellings or getting so many sums right. It's like that, you know, that, is it the TED talk? I can't remember. Is it Rita Pearson who does, it's Every Child Deserves a Champion? it's worth having a watch. It's very inspiring. It makes you look at spelling tests in a whole different way.
Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes, definitely. Is there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
Yeah, I had, outside of my mum, I have to say she probably was my favourite teacher of all time, but that sounds very cringeworthy, but she was brilliant and she was definitely ahead of her time.
Did she treat you differently to the other children?
Oh, she was much harder on me. And obviously I was quite good at reading and she always put me, you know, at certain groups. I never got to sit beside my friends, but no, she was definitely harder on me at the time, I would have felt, but I still would have made the quiz team and things like that, which is nice, but I learned a lot from her. But I remember having a teacher, Master Byrne, as a sub when I was in second class, and he was a retired teacher, and he was really, really cross, but he did lovely things, like he taught us lovely poems, and he never made us do our workbooks or anything like that, and he used to take us to the beach or take us out to the GAA pitch, which nobody ever got to go out with. Actually, it was a soccer field, and nobody else was ever allowed to go up there, and we would get to, you know, read stories and things outside, and I don't know what it was about him. He was like a grandfather figure probably as well, but he probably stood out to me as one of the most kind of interesting and inspiring teachers that we had, and we were always very sad when he went away. We never know. We didn't want our own teacher to come back from maternity leave then, even though I'm sure she was lovely. But yeah, Master Byrne probably, because he kind of went outside the box and it showed that we didn't have to be using our textbooks and doing all the boring things to actually be learning loads.
He made a strong impression.
Definitely.
And was there anyone else who inspired you, Clara?
In secondary school I had a really, really brilliant English teacher, Mr. Donnelly. And he went bats when I said I was going to do teaching, because he was always pushing me to do writing and be a writer or be a journalist or whatever. But I meet him at home now on the shore. So I was telling him there a couple of weeks ago that I actually do lecture in English methods now, and he was over the moon, because he was worried, you know, that I would get pigeonholed and, you know, stuck in a rut and doing the same thing. But I told him all along, you know, that I never let the English go, I never let the writing go. And then, you know, that I went back and did my master's and I set up the blog. But I do owe a lot of it to him, because he really, like, I don't know, ignited a spark in terms of creative writing. And he gave us the opportunity to do a lot of creative writing in secondary school that probably, you know, wasn't really timetabled. And I just have visions of him reading of Mice and Men and different texts and like bringing them to life for even the most, you know, standoffish, reluctant student in the corner. Because you had some characters in the classroom who really weren't there, you know, for the love of learning or whatever, but there was definitely stages where he had everybody, you know, hanging on every word of every chapter of the different texts. And definitely his work and his teaching inspired a lot of my writing and my interest in writing, and definitely how I approach teaching English as well.
And did other students in the class think as highly of him as you did, do you think?
Oh, definitely.
So what was it about him? What was his approach that just made it so inspirational for you?
He left the room. Mr. Donnelly was gone, and the character of the book that he was reading was there, or the narrator of the novel or whatever it was. When he started to read, you didn't see him anymore. He had a really, really powerful way of telling a story and bringing a story to life, and like even critiquing a piece of work that you've written and making a suggestion that you would never have thought of, and just making time for writing and creativity, I think was lovely. Because I think in secondary school sometimes, back when I was in secondary school, there wasn't a lot of time for creativity. There was, you know, because it was so based on rote learning and regurgitating history.
And the pressure to have exam results.
Exactly.
But he didn't seem to worry so much about that.
He still managed to teach everything, but he taught us to be creative and not always to go for the kind of prescribed answer, and to look for the different question or think, you know, right, when you look at this poem now, think about what the average person is going to respond to that, and then think of something else. Think of the examiner who's, you know, correcting 1,000 of the same paper, and why is yours going to jump out? What do you see that the other person, you know, won't have seen?
So he was encouraging you to be strategic.
Yeah. Well, strategic, but I think he was encouraging us to be creative as well and think outside the box.
Who or what inspires you?
Again, I know I'm going to say it again, but I find my mum very inspiring, because she's a prime example of somebody who has done it all. Like, she can raise a family. She did her PhD while still putting, you know, two kids through secondary school. Well, actually, my younger sister would have been in primary school at the time, and I would have been teaching, and my other brother would have been in college. we had a great upbringing, but, you know, both my parents, you know, have a great attitude to life and to work, but a great balance as well, I think. And yeah, that would have to be it, I think.
And you now are doing your own PhD. Mm-hmm. What's the topic of that?
Oh, play and literacy. I'm looking at the significance play-based learning or playful pedagogy has to have in the development of early communication and early literacy competencies, really. I'm at that awkward part where you're trying to refine your research questions and not go down too many roads, which is really hard.
Have you a favourite writer, book or blog about education?
There's a lady, Jen Jones, based in America. I'm really interested in her work. She's just an educational consultant who goes around and she teaches teachers how to teach reading and how to implement really useful strategies for the classroom. And she's all based around picture books and visual learning. And one of the big messages that she gives is that reading pictures is reading, or reading pictures is still reading. And that's something that really rings with me. And I always say it to the students myself, like I was working with the B-Ed 2s who are obviously going to have 5th and 6th class now in placement. And we were looking at inference questioning today, which isn't the most pleasant of topics, and everybody can find that a little bit tricky because they're always like, what actually is an inference, you know? But we were looking at visuals and they definitely all went home today now understanding in their head that reading pictures is still reading.
What from your own primary or secondary education informs your practice in education today?
I think seeing, you know, the different types of learners and that we all learn differently and that it's really important to, you know, adapt our teaching to suit how the children learn and that one way doesn't suit all. Because obviously all through my schooling, there would have been a huge diversity in terms of the learning skills and how different people learn. And I have flashbacks of like round robin reading in secondary school and just, you know, dying inside when you knew it was going to come to somebody who was going to struggle. And like, it wasn't fair. And like, the teacher just went with it because it was routine. And I think breaking from routine and changing things up, and just because you've had the plans from last year, you know, doesn't mean that you need to use the same plans again, and adapting and changing things. But I think definitely being aware of the, you know, the different types of learner and multiple intelligence would be key there.
And how are you finding the transition from being teacher to being teacher educator?
Well, you're still teaching. It was strange for the first couple of weeks there where we were just doing induction and we were in the office and stuff. I found that a bit strange, and because my colleague who I'm sharing an office with wasn't in yet, and I was a bit like, oh, I don't know about this. But now that I've got back into the swing of lectures, I love it. I'm delighted. I had play-based learning lectures or workshops yesterday with the third years and we had so much fun. And then I've had a couple of the literacy lectures now and they've just been great. So yeah, I've made the right choice.
And the best of luck with it, Clara.
Thank you.
You've said you're from the Inishowen Peninsula, mm-hmm. but your name, Fiorentini, is not exactly a Donegal name. So where did that come from?
No, my great-grandfather came from Italy back in 1912 over to Derry, all on his own, aged 11. He was sent over to work with some cousins. They had a cafe in Derry City. Derry had a big naval base back then, so obviously it was a hive of activity and really busy. And he sold ice cream in Derry, and then obviously set up his own business, then moved across the border down to Moville. They used to set up a shop, I think, in the summer, and then himself and his younger brother, and then he himself set up a shop in Moville, and they moved down there. And I think the one in Moville was set up in 1935, and then my grandfather took it over, and then my uncle Frank took it over after that. And there's still the cafe in Derry that my dad's cousin actually still runs as well. So Fiorentini's is still there. It's on the kind of to-do list when you go to Derry. So if you're ever in Derry, you'll have to look it up.
But he came to Ireland on his own.
On his own, yeah.
As an 11-year-old.
They were actually, I think they were supposed to go to New York, and his father had been there, but I think he got injured or something on the railways, so he had to come home. Because obviously if you weren't fit to work, you weren't able to stay. So then the next thing was to send your oldest child out to work, so he was sent over to Ireland. So yeah, there's an Italian connection.
Oh, that's fantastic. So if people want to catch up with you through all your social media areas, what's the best way? Is the website the best way, or Instagram? Maybe if you just give some of those details.
Yeah, so the website is littlemissteacher.com, or you can find me on Instagram under Little Miss Teacher Blog, Facebook, Little Miss Teacher Blog, and Twitter. I think I'm Clara Fiorentini, but yeah, I share like everything from the blog there as well, usually too.
And it's well worth catching up with Clara on any of those social media platforms. Next, we go to a new section of the podcast. You've all heard of the three R's. Well, I can think of five R's that interests me. And that is a rant, a research finding, a response to a listener's question, a review, or a recommendation. And occasionally, I'll select one of these R's to share with you on the programme. And this week, it's a recommendation. The recommendation I want to make on the podcast this week is for another podcast called Speak Up Storytelling. It's a weekly podcast about storytelling that is produced by husband and wife team, Matthew and Alicia Dix. Both Matthew and Alicia Dix are primary teachers and they teach in a local school in Hartford, Connecticut. And although the podcast is not specifically geared towards teachers, it certainly is informed by teachers and it has a lot to offer to teachers. It's a wonderful resource for teachers who are interested in using the power of storytelling in their classrooms. At the centre of every podcast is a storyteller telling a story about an event for their lives. And this is followed by a critique of the story by Alicia and Matthew. The kind of stories that are featured on Speak Up are stories about people's own lives where they encounter a transformation or a realization and they present that moment in as compelling a story as they possibly can. Now, even if you're not interested in that kind of storytelling, if the kind of stories you'll be telling in your classroom are myths and legends or Bible stories or existing stories, there are still an awful lot of really good ideas in this podcast about how to tell a story, about how to put a story together, about identifying the transformative moment in a story and then structuring the story about that. In addition to the podcast, Matthew Dix has written a book called Storyworthy: Engage, Teach, Persuade and Change Your Life Through the Power of Storytelling. And I would really recommend that book. It's a long book. There's almost 350 pages in it. The book covers many important ideas about storytelling, such as what tense to use, how to find stories, and what he calls the principle of but and therefore. To date, Matthew and Alicia Dix have produced over 60 storytelling podcasts, and they really are worth listening to for the stories themselves and how they are critiqued and what you will learn about telling and finding good stories. I would highly recommend the podcast Speak Up Storytelling by husband and wife team, Matthew and Alicia Dix, and the book, the accompanying book, if you like, Storyworthy by Matthew Dix. And that recommendation from me brings this week's Inside Education to a close. I appreciate your company on this week's podcast. Go to insideed.com to find the show notes for this episode and links to sites and resources mentioned by Clara. You can listen back to this week's podcast or any previous episode on seandelaney.com/podcasts. If you liked this week's podcast, I'd be delighted if you'd leave a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you've done that already, please tell someone you know about the podcast. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from online bookstores and from several local libraries. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.